Are you a Coast insider? No? Well, that's sad. And it's sad because you're going to miss the Andrew Basiago chat tomorrow night, which is going to be really, really fascinating and dynamic. And not only that, all the other chats that take place for Coast to Coast insiders, plus that extraordinary archive, incredible information, information just as extraordinary as you're hearing tonight. All for Coast Insiders in the Coast to Coast AM archive. And it's less than a quarter a day, an unbeatable deal. Coast Insider, you got to go there. You got to do that. This week, by the way, on Dreamland, on unknowncountry.com, we're having our Christmas special. And next week, we're going to have our New Year's special where all of the Dreamland team, me, Jim Mars, Ann Streber, Linda Moulton Howe, William Henry, talk about the coming year, 2012. And we're going to be talking about it with Graham Hancock as well over the course of the next couple of hours. He's got some absolutely fascinating things to say about it, as you may imagine. We are entangled with our distant past in a very special and unusual way. And there's an extraordinary book about this called Entangled, written by Graham Hancock, and I urge you to read it. They call it fiction, but is it that? You must follow Graham Hancock down this path, because down the path of Entangled, there is some kind of a new way of looking at space and time that enables us to look deep into the distant past as if through a time telescope. It's a marvelously put together piece of work. Graham Hancock's Entangled. How do we recover our memories of the distant past? What have we lost? Why are we in amnesia? Because I think Graham's made an unimpeachable case tonight. We are missing something huge. Where was it? What kind of technologies did it possess? Well, when we get back, that's exactly what I'm going to be talking to Graham about with. Graham with? About. Well, whatever I'm going to be doing, we're going to be doing it when we get back and we explore ancient technologies and where this place may have been. We'll be right back. This is Whitley Strieber sitting in for George Nuri tonight. George is on vacation this week. Graham Hancock's website, grahamhancock.com, his YouTube channel, youtube.com, then grahamhancock.com, just spell it all out, or simply search YouTube for Graham Hancock and you will find his channel. Graham, let me ask you this. You've made quite a search for the Ark of the Covenant, and it was a marvelous, the book you wrote about it was absolutely delightful. It was a real adventure, high adventure of the First Order. Anne was so absorbed by it. That's how we discovered you, was with that book.
And then I found Fingerprints of the Gods on a table in a bookstore, and I never looked back.
Yeah. Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Well, The Sign and the Seal, the book I wrote about the Ark of the Covenant, was really my initiation into these mysteries, because I was a pretty mainstream guy before that. You know, as you said in the original intro, I was, you know, the East Africa correspondent for The Economist. I was totally into current affairs. I wrote a book about foreign aid in the 1980s called Lords of Poverty. I was a correspondent. I covered wars. I covered famines in the East Africa region. I was very much focused on politics and economics and current affairs. But, you know, I stumbled across, Ethiopia was one of the countries that was on my beat, and I stumbled across this extraordinary claim that the Ethiopians make to possess the lost Ark of the Covenant. And I found myself in the city of Aksum in 1982 or 83, when the city was in government hands but was surrounded by rebel forces. And I got into it on an old DC-3 aircraft, which was used to ferry the wounded in and out of the battle zone. And it did a kind of nosedive.
You're a regular Indiana Jones.
Those were the days, you know. Those were the days. I was living a life of high adventure, and landed in Aksum. The pilots did a kind of nosedive into the airport because there were machine gun nests in the hills round about, and they couldn't do a long, slow approach. And I got off the plane and I spent a couple of days in Aksum. And while I was there, I went into the ancient cathedral of St. Mary of Zion. It's actually the oldest Christian cathedral in Africa. It's older than any of European Christendom. There was a cathedral built there in the 3rd century after Christ. And in the grounds of the cathedral is a chapel. And in that chapel, outside the chapel, in fact, I met a monk with cataracts over his eyes, an old man, very powerful demeanor, a kind of quiet certainty about him. And he told me that behind us in that chapel, he had the Ark of the Covenant. And I said, you know, the most famous object of the Bible, the greatest mystery of the Bible, which went missing some time, more than 500, 600 years before Christ. You've got it here in Aksum. And he said, he said, yes. And I said, can I see it? And he said, no, you can't see it. Nobody's allowed to see it except me. I'm the guardian of the Ark.
Now, this fascinates me. Why not?
Well, it turns out to be the case. I researched it in depth afterwards. Even the emperors of Ethiopia before Ethiopia's revolution were never allowed to see this object. And when the object is moved, it is wrapped in incredibly thick surroundings made of animal skin and of cloth. And they say that they wrap it not to protect it, but to protect the public from it.
It seems to be radioactive or something, doesn't it?
Well, this was the thing that immediately hit me, was the cataracts in the guy's eyes. And I said to him, what is the Ark of the Covenant? And he turned those blind eyes on me, and he said through the translator, the Ark is a thing of fire.
Ah.
And that sent shivers down my spine, and I felt that I was being addressed by truth at that point. And he said,
wow.
Look what it's done to my eyes. It's made me blind. And over the subsequent years, I went back many times to Aksum. And Aksum eventually changed hands and became a rebel stronghold. And I went with the rebels crossing from the Sudan by four-wheel drive vehicle, driving through the mountains, through into Eritrea and the mountains of Ethiopia, traveling at night because we were being strafed by government aircraft during the day, and reaching Aksum again. And I found that the guardian had changed several times, because these guardians, once they're appointed as guardian of the Ark, first of all, they may never again leave the grounds of the sanctuary chapel. They become a prisoner of the Ark. And secondly, they have a very short lifespan. And I met another guardian with the same problem, with the cataracts over his eyes, and the same story, that this had been caused by the Ark of the Covenant, that he'd been blinded.
Lord.
So it's kind of a sacrifice to be appointed this.
Well, in a sense, yes. I mean, they are giving up their life to be the guardian of the Ark.
Has anyone ever gone near this building Geiger counter?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. Obviously the thing that comes to mind is, you know, this is an incredibly important object to Israel. Israel has Mossad and it has, you know, formidable armed forces. Didn't they ever think of going and snatching it? And so I did actually put this question to the Ethiopian ambassador in Addis Ababa in Eritrea. And what he said to me is, my goodness, under no circumstances would we go and snatch the Ark. That's the last thing we want back in Israel at the moment.
You mean to the Israeli ambassador?
Yeah, I spoke to the Israeli ambassador in Ethiopia at that time in the 90s. And I said, well, you know, this is an object that's fundamental to your culture. Why don't you guys go grab it? You've got the technology. You've got the power. He said, no way. No way would we do that. We actually don't want the Ark of the Covenant back in Israel, because it would become a focal point of fundamentalist struggles. There is a prophecy in Shia Islam concerning the hidden Mahdi, that he will, who, by the way, is the source of the name of the Mahdi army in Iraq and so on, and is associated with many horrific acts of suicide bombing and so on and so forth, that there's a figure called the hidden Mahdi in Shia Islam, who was hidden from the sight of man by God, supposedly in the 8th or 9th century after Christ, and who is due to return in our time today, and to lead what they see as the battle of good against evil, against the great Satan, which they associate with the United States and with Israel, and that the fundamental thing that the hidden Mahdi must do before he leads this struggle to recapture the Holy Land for Islam is to produce the Ark of the Covenant. There are fundamentalists. Jews, for example, the Temple Mount faithful, who have the same apocalyptic belief that they must recover the Ark of the Covenant and build the third temple on the Temple Mount.
Won't these people be...
There are fundamentalist Christians who follow the Book of Revelations, in which the return of the Ark of the Covenant is one of the signs of the Day of Judgment. And so when you look at all that, I could actually understand why this very rational, very secular ambassador of Israel, the last thing he wanted was this object back in Israel.
Now, the Ark of the Covenant is the box that was built to hold the tablets of the Ten Commandments.
Correct.
Okay, in case anybody doesn't know.
Can I just say, a kind of blueprint is given for the Ark of the Covenant in the Book of Exodus. And from that blueprint, where God literally gives the instructions to Moses as to how to build the Ark of the Covenant, we can tell that it was 3 feet 9 inches long, 2 feet 3 inches high and wide. It consisted of an outer golden box with an inner wooden box with a further inner golden box inside it. And so inside those three layers of gold, wood, gold is placed the tablets of the Ten Commandments,
but why
upon
is it,
which God has written with his own finger.
And why is it so dangerous?
Power.
Why is it so dangerous? I don't understand. I was just going to bring this whole issue up because when you read the biblical description of its construction, there's nothing in that to suggest the danger. And yet the Ark, in its when it was in the hands of the Israelites, obviously was an extremely powerful object of some kind.
That's right. I mean, the box is constructed, and if you think of it, the box actually sounds like an incredibly effective radiation shield.
Does gold shield radiation?
Gold absolutely shields radiation. It shields it better than lead.
Really?
And we have two boxes of gold separated by a wooden box, so there's a real resistance being built into this casket, and then this these objects written upon by the finger of God himself, as it's expressed in the Old Testament, are placed inside it, energized from the Old Testament view with the power of the deity. But there's a suggestion that, which is a number of very serious Hebrew scholars have looked into, that we're looking at some sort of object that fell from the sky. The suggestion is a meteorite, but one's mind may range further than that possibility. Perhaps we're even looking at a piece of extraterrestrial technology that powers the Ark. Once these stone objects, supposedly stone objects, are placed inside the Ark, it becomes energized with power, and it starts immediately to be very, very dangerous. Bolts of fire shoot out from it and strike dead anybody who's foolish enough to touch the box. There's the famous story of Uzzah in the Old Testament, when the Ark is being brought up on the back of a cart to the city of Jerusalem by King David. Uzzah reaches out to touch it and is struck dead by a bolt of fire. The reason it's on a cart at all is that in battle, the Philistines have seized the Ark, and they use it as a sort of tourist thing in the city of Ashdod. They open the Ark of the Covenant, and 30,000 Philistines file past it to look at it, and what the Bible tells us is that all of them die. They all die of cancerous tumors. That is the actual phrase that is used in the Bible, that they die of cancer.
So let's accept that it must be in some way a radioactive object, which would also suggest that it may very well still exist, because something like that would be hard to lose and hard to destroy. Now, but why would anyone have put these laws, which are the fundamental structural underpinnings of our civilization, on something that is so radioactive that you can't even get near it?
Well, maybe it isn't the laws. Maybe the laws, sorry, this may annoy some believers, but maybe the laws are just a cover story. The commandments are just a cover story, that the box contains commandments. I mean, if you have commandments, do you close them up in a box, or do you put them out in the open?
Well, that's my point, exactly.
for people to read. What you close up in a box is something dangerous, and the box becomes dangerous, and it's used by the Israelites in their conquest of Palestine.
Whatever it is the insulation around it isn't all that effective. Wouldn't be getting cataracts and dying.
Well, exactly. It's a limited radiation shield. If it's radiation in the conventional sense, as we understand it,
which it may not even be. Now, but you've mentioned now a number of different strains of fundamentalism, all of whom might have a motive Definitely do have a motive for getting a hold of it, even by force.
Yes.
Why don't they? I wonder yet.
Well,
maybe they will.
One thing I learned when I was up in Tigray in Aksum is that you don't mess with the Tigrayans. I mean, they are the guardians of the Ark today. The people of Tigray, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, who conquered the largest standing army in Africa, and who the whole of Aksum is an armed camp. So it's protected in that sense. The traditions in Ethiopia is that there is a system of tunnels, a network of tunnels beneath the sanctuary chapel that the Ark can be taken down into and removed to a further location if it's under threat. But really, I mean, you know, we're looking at a scenario where that is possible, because you have these three fundamentalist strains from the three different monotheistic religions, which all need the Ark of the Covenant to bring about, unfortunately, the end of the world as we know it. I mean, there's a sort of death cult, you know, looking at the Day of Judgment and seeking to bring that on. And in each of the three religions of monotheism, the Ark of the Covenant's return to Jerusalem is the fundamental issue. So it's a really hot, dangerous political issue right now. And when the Ethiopians say that it is in Ethiopia because that's where God wants it to be, you have to listen to them. You know, maybe that's just the very best place for it to be, in the remote highlands of Africa, very difficult to access, surrounded by people who fought a massive civil war and overthrew the largest standing army in Africa, surrounded by tunnels where it can be taken and disappeared off into the mountains, and very difficult to find. Maybe that's a really good place for this dangerous, poisonous object to be.
A piece of technology, perhaps, from a distant past, in which, even if we couldn't go to the stars, from the way the maps, like the Piri Reis map that you referred to earlier, look, we certainly could fly.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, absolutely, we could fly.
Evidence of that. And of course, ancient Indian traditions, you know, everybody's heard of the Vimanas, the flying aircraft that are spoken of in the Vedas and in the Bhagavata Purana and the Ramayana, you know, that there are really accounts of flying machines with powerful engines that also radiate energy.
And the Nazca lines. Nobody can figure out how anybody made those, or why they would have made them on the ground if they couldn't see them from the air, because they only make sense from the air.
They only make sense from the air. I've flown over the Nazca lines many, many times, and when you're down at ground level, they're just ruts in the desert. But you get up into the air, and this extraordinary tableau of geoglyphs spreads out below you and just stuns and awes the mind, you know, the scale of this work. And in some ways, the Nazca lines remind me a little bit of crop circles, too. You know, because again, they are only visible in their true form from the air. That's when you really realize what you're dealing with. Majestic works of art on a geographical scale, spread out below you and visible only from the air. This is the huge mystery of the Nazca Lines, and it's one of the many mysteries of crop circles, too.
When we get back, we're going to go even deeper with Graham Hancock. Such a powerful ancient civilization. What happened to it? We'll be back. We're back. We're talking to Graham Hancock. His website, grahamhancock.com. He's got a YouTube channel. Go to YouTube and spell out grahamhancock.com. You'll get right to it. His marvelous new book, Entangled, we're going to be talking about that with him in just a moment. Quite interesting. Are we still entangled in some way with this distant past? Is it still here? What did Isaac Newton actually know? And why would Isaac Newton, at a time when the Great Pyramid was hardly known in the Western world, when it was covered up to 30 feet with sand and completely ignored, would he have known what he knew about it? Where is that ancient strain of knowledge going? Is there somebody alive today who has possession of those secrets, who knows what the Ark of the Covenant was, who knows who we really are and who we where we came from? And why is it like this? Was there a war? Is it because the Indian records that he referred to suggest there may have been a tremendous war using advanced weapons in the distant past that might have been perfectly capable of wiping a civilization off the face of the earth? Or was there some kind of a natural catastrophe, or both? We're going to ask Graham all of these questions. In my mind, they're burning questions, because as we see the world around us changing so rapidly in so many different ways, and they're good ways and bad ways, and we all know and fear the bad ways, we don't talk enough, I don't think, about the good ways. And I was glad to talk with Ralph Steiner a little bit about those. But what does the distant past tell us about the possibility that there could be radical, dramatic, and sudden change in our civilization? That's what we're looking to find out tonight. We'll be right back. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Coast to Coast AM. I'm sitting in for George Nouri tonight. We're back with Graham Hancock. Graham, tell us a little bit about this marvelous book, and I loved it when I read it, and that's why I gave it a blurb that's on the cover, Entangled.
Thank you, Whitley.
Yeah, because it's...
Thank you for your blurb, and thank you for liking the book, because this is my first adventure into quote-unquote fiction. I'm known as a non-fiction writer, Fingerprints of the Gods, The Sign and the Seal, Heaven's Mirror, Message of the Sphinx, so on and so forth. These have all been non-fiction books, heavily footnoted. You know, Underworld has got something like 2,000 footnotes, very heavily referenced. I hope and believe thorough works of scholarship. But I found that there were certain issues, certain extraordinary areas of human experience that I thought could be better explored using the vehicle of fiction. And that's why I wrote Entangled, which is fundamentally about the battle of good against evil and the human place in this story on a universal scale. And it involves time travel through the vehicle of altered states of consciousness. So we have two young women, Leone in the 21st century Los Angeles, and Rhea 24,000 years ago in northern Spain, who are brought together by supernatural forces to do battle with a demon who travels through time. That demon is about to perpetrate an act of horrific evil in the Stone Age, the utter annihilation of our cousins, the Neanderthals. And Rhea and Leone are brought together to prevent him from doing that, because if he does that, he will be able to manifest in physical form in the 21st century. And his whole mission is to lead mankind astray. And underlying this thesis that lies at the heart of Entangled is a very ancient system of ideas that we are not alone, that we are enmeshed in a invisible soup of influences, that entities that we give names to, like angels and demons, are real conscious forces in the universe, and that they play with the human race, the angelic side seeking to make us the best that we can possibly be, and the demonic side seeking to make us the worst that we can possibly be, seeking to mislead us. The Hermetic texts call these demons evil angels who walk amongst mankind.
And walk amongst us. In other words, they walk amongst us, and they can appear in physical form.
They can manifest in physical form, and this is right. Precisely the project of the demon Sulpa in my story Entangled, that his objective is to manifest in physical form in the 21st century.
You know, when you read it, you understand that how real this can actually be, that it may be a work of fiction, but it may also describe a process that's quite real.
Yeah, this is my feeling. This is what I set out to do. That at a certain level, fiction is the best way to explore extraordinary ideas. You know, you don't have to get bogged down in endless nitpicking arguments with academics, which I've spent far too much of my life doing. You know,
well, it's an extraordinary, really a good trip, quite a trip Entangled is. I want to ask, you mentioned time travel.
Yeah.
And now on a beam in the, I believe it's the Temple of Dendera. I'm sure you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
There are some images that appear to be modern, I believe a modern tank, in fact, even identifiable as a Russian tank.
Yeah, it's so weird, and identifiable fighter aircraft, and they are really ancient glyphs, you know. Well, the Temple of Dendera, to put it in perspective, the Temple of Dendera stands on a very ancient site where there has been a temple going back to the beginnings of Egyptian civilization, but the Temple of Dendera, as we see it today, is relatively late in the Egyptian story, was built during Ptolemaic times, and around about 150, 200 years before Christ. It's a completely intact temple, which has its roof in place, a majestic temple. It's full of astronomical glyphs. There are two zodiacs in the Temple of Zodiac, the so-called the Temple of Dendera, the so-called square zodiac downstairs, and the circular zodiac in a chapel upstairs, which themselves appear to encode ancient stellar positions as though they're speaking, they're using the stars as time markers for movement through time. And yes, indeed, in that temple are a series of glyphs which actually very closely, identically resemble known fighter aircraft and known types of tanks in the modern world today. This is very, very bizarre. Now, of course, our friends, the Egyptologists, have an answer to this. They say it's totally a coincidence that one glyph was carved on top of another and it just happened to look like, you know, a T-72 tank or whatever.
Not a T-34. It's a more recent tank than that, but yes.
72, yes. A
72, one. Yeah, that's right.
And you know, this is the explanation that they give, but it defies belief when you actually look at these glyphs and see how astonishingly they do resemble fighter jet aircraft and tanks. And it makes you wonder, you know, especially with the time theme at Dendera. First of all, that here's a temple built in a known period of time, 2nd century before Christ, but on the site of an earlier temple, which stood on the site of an earlier temple, which stood on the site of an even earlier temple, going back into the mists of prehistory, which has astronomical motifs in its ceilings, which seem to use the stars as a vehicle for navigating through time. Same thing happens at Giza. You know, if we want a reference to time, the stars are a wonderful universal way of doing it. Not many people know this. You know, everybody's heard of the wonderful Orion correlation, which is the genius discovery of my friend and often co-author Robert Bovall in his book The Orion Mystery, that the three stars of Orion's belt are matched by the pattern of the three great pyramids on the ground. And when you go in depth into the astronomy, you find that the perfect match takes place not in 2500 BC, when the pyramids are supposed to have been built, but in 10,500 BC at the end of the last ice age. Now,
when an absolutely incredible catastrophe was enveloping planet Earth.
Indeed. In 10,500 BC, planet Earth was passing through a just horrific cataclysm that makes, you know, modern ideas of global warming and tsunamis and so on just look like very small beer.
And I mean, maybe these people knew very well what was happening and left what record they could of what they knew. Does that make sense to you?
It makes perfect sense to me that a record was left drawing our attention to that time, and that the Giza Plateau is a creation of the survivors of the cataclysm. That's my view, that the survivors of a high civilization after the Earth had again stabilized somewhere around 12,500 years ago, 10,500 BC, after that cataclysm was over, they created the Giza Plateau to draw our attention to that event. And they used the universal, mathematical, beautiful precision of the stars as a means of drawing our attention to that time. And though that seems an extraordinary idea, let's remember that there is a star map built into the architecture of the Hoover Dam in the United States. and that star map freezes the skies above the Hoover Dam on the date the dam was completed, and that the reason it was put there was specifically stated by the architect: if in 10,000 years our civilization is lost, our language is lost, nobody understands our writing, and future archaeologists come across the remains of the Hoover Dam, they will be able to work out from the star map when it was actually built.
But they're liable to say it was just a coincidence.
But then, exactly, those archaeologists of that time, they'll have that reference frame where there could have been no lost civilization in the past, and they'll say, no, it's all just a coincidence. This is just a fantasy of lunatic fringes, you know, who are making things up. But actually, you know, I have to say, in mythological terms, if there were ever a civilization that looks like the next lost civilization, our civilization is it. We do, however, have the choice. I'm not going around the world wearing a sandwich board saying the end of the world is nigh. I believe in the power of the human spirit.
No, me too.
Yeah, I know. We're on the same page, Whitley. I believe that this is a time of awakening of the human race, that we're coming into a new age, a new evolution, and all around the world, in every culture, people are waking up and throwing off the old dead hand that's been gripping our consciousness and our imagination for so long. We're resisting the fear and the hatred and the suspicion that our governments deliberately engender, that our large corporations deliberately engender to divide us from one another, the grotesque nationalisms, the narrow religious interests, and again, fear, hatred, suspicion. That's what's drummed out on our mainstream media all the time. More and more people are waking up and resisting that, resisting it with the very fiber of their being. People are waking up and saying, no, we do not want fear. We do not want hatred. We do not want suspicion. The antidote to all of these things is love. Love is the antidote. Love, you know, we talk
about
things in short supply.
So you see 2012 as being a very different kind of an experience than from the, because the media is going to be, I mean, not Coast, but the mainstream media is going to be beating the drum for the end of the world in December of 2012, knowing in advance, of course, that it's fairly unlikely that that's going to happen.
Well, maybe it's the end of the old world, like Graham is talking about. It's the end of the old superstitious, rule-bound world, controlled by guilt, controlled by rules.
Exactly, Anne. You're absolutely right. That's how I see it, and you know that's how the Maya saw it too. It's wrong to say that the Mayan calendar predicts the end of the world on the 21st of December 2012. What the Mayan calendar predicts is the end of a cycle, the end of an epoch, the end of an age, in that time window, the center of which is the 21st of December 2012. Because this is not a moment, this is a process. It's a process that's been unfolding for the last 50 or 60 years and likely will continue to unfold for the next 50 or 60 years. And we can all feel it. But in the center of the window is the winter solstice sunrise on 21st of December 2012, when the sun rises against the background of the center of our galaxy, of the Milky Way. But for the Maya, this did not mean the end of the world. It meant rebirth. In fact, the Milky Way was envisaged as a birth canal in the symbolic language of the ancient Maya. And the appearance of the sun in the middle of that celestial birth canal powerfully symbolically suggests rebirth and the beginning of a new age. So the Mayan calendar is that the long count is a 5,100-year period, and it's interesting that it begins in 3,114 BC, before Christ, the latest cycle of the long count. That's exactly the time of the beginning of the great states, the great so-called historical civilizations dominated by powerful hierarchical governments, the system that has imposed itself upon our world for the last 5,100 years, because 3,100 BC, when the calendar begins, is 5,100 years ago. And that long count cycle, which is the epoch of the dominator culture, of the powerful states, of the disenfranchised citizen who is controlled like a puppet by nameless forces, that era comes to an end, according to the Mayan calendar, on the 21st of December 2012. It does not mean the end of the world. It means an awakening, and all around the world, we can sense that awakening taking place.
And what it is the end of blindness. We begin to see who we really are, where we really came from, and what we can actually accomplish. So I look upon it as incredibly positive event. Now, but I want to go back now to that period, 10,500 years ago. What exactly happened to this planet, Graham? I know that the great Laurentide Glacier, which covered the northern half of North America, suddenly disintegrated. Apparently, it was struck by something that left, I think, as I recall, icebergs hit as far south as New Mexico and all through the Carolinas. The so-called Carolina Dells are the were created by ice that flew off of that glacier.
Well, something hit our planet around about that period, 10,500 BC, give or take a few hundred years. There's no doubt that we were subjected to a gigantic cosmic impact, and that that impact was instrumental in bringing the Ice Age to an end. You know, we have this thing called the Ice Age, which lasted from 125,000 years ago down to about 12,500 years ago, where you have ice sheets, you know, 2 miles deep sitting on top of North America as far south as the Mississippi Delta and sitting on top of Northern Europe. Imagine that, 2 miles thick ice.
It's unbelievable that it could be there, but it was there.
It was there, mountains of ice.
Mountains of ice. You have dived cities, because of course all of that water being concentrated in that ice means the sea level was far, far lower than it is now.
Well, exactly. The sea level was 400 feet lower all around the world.
So there could be the civilizations of that time must have been on the shore.
10 million square miles of land that is now underwater was above water then. And 10 million square miles of land is roughly the size of Europe and China added together. That's a huge amount of habitable land that's been subtracted from the human story in the recent past, in the last 12,500 years.
And is practically untouched by archaeology.
Practically untouched by archaeologists, because marine archaeology is primarily interested in shipwrecks. They're not interested in the notion that the remnants of a lost civilization might be found underwater off the continental shelves.
But didn't you dive a city off the coast of India? And
I've dived underwater ruins all around the world. Myself and my wife, Santa, who's a photographer, spent 6 years of our lives putting in hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dives. We lost count of how many, all around the world, in the Mediterranean, in the Indian Ocean, in the Red Sea, in Eastern Asia, off Taiwan, off Japan, across the Pacific, in Micronesia, for example, off the Canary Islands, just diving everywhere. And in all these places, there are strange and mysterious ruins underwater, which local fishermen and local divers have encountered and are mystified by, and we went looking for those underwater ruins, and that was my, you know, last big non-fiction book on the lost civilization theme was Underworld, which documents that.
Which is an absolutely great book.
And Santa took incredible photographs.
Well, Santa incredible. Put her life on the line. Yeah, she put her life on the line.
I mean, aren't they on your website, I hope?
Yeah, we have quite a few of them on the website. We're planning to put up a whole lot more before too long. You know, I would be lost in my life if it was not for my beautiful and wonderful partner, Santa, who's just stood by me every step of the way. And I know you're the same, Whitley, with your beautiful partner, Anne.
With Anne,
We're blessed by these wonderful women
in our lives. We're definitely teams, both of us, and we have been on incredible adventures. In fact, Anne's new diary, as I alluded to earlier in the show, talks eloquently about some of the challenges of that adventure that she and I have been on. And I also feel incredibly grateful for the presence of my wonderful adventurer in my life. When we get back, folks, we're going to be taking your calls for Graham Hancock. So get ready. I'm sure you have a load of questions, and I can tell that he's ready to answer them. We'll be right back.